day. He was 63 years old, dressed, as always, in a suit and tie, with a narrow gold band on his forefinger. Elaine had given it to him for his 50th birthday. Coming into the slightly darkened room, he always struck me as a godfather figure, as in the famous film. There was no sense of menace, but Charles looked Italian, with piercing eyes, a very thin nose, and quite aristocratic cheekbones. He had white hair, which swept down in a careless sort of way, brushing against his collar. He was quite fit for a man of his age, not that he would have dreamed of going anywhere near a gym, and he was very much in command. He often brought his dog when he came into work, and there it was now, a golden Labrador asleep on a folded blanket under the desk. The dog's name was Bella. "Come in, Susan," he said, waving me in from the door. I was carrying the typescript with me. I came in and sat down, and saw now that he was looking very pale, almost in shock. "You've heard," he said. I nodded. There were articles in all the newspapers, and I'd heard the author, Ian Rankin, talking about him on the Today program. My first thought when I heard the news was that he must have had a heart attack. Wasn't that what most commonly struck down men of his age? But I was wrong. Now they were saying it was an accident. It had happened at his home near Framlingham. "It's terrible news," Charles said. "Absolutely terrible." "Do you know what happened?" I asked. "The police rang me last night. I spoke to a detective superintendent, Locke. He was calling from Ipswich, I think. He said exactly what they're saying on the radio. An accident. But he wouldn't go into any more detail than that. And then this morning, just a few minutes ago, I received this." He picked up a letter that had been lying on the desk. There was a roughly torn open envelope beside it. "It came in the Morning Post. It's from Alan." "Can I see it?" "Of course." He handed it to me. "This letter is important, so I am including an exact reproduction. Abbey Grange, Framlingham, Suffolk. 28th of August, 2015. Dear Charles, I don't like apologies, but I wasn't on my best form at dinner last night, I will admit. You know I've been out of sorts recently, and I didn't want to tell you, but I might as well come straight out with it. I'm not well. Actually, that's putting it mildly. Dr. Sheila Bennett at the London Clinic has all the details, but effectively, I'm about to be killed by the biggest bloody cliché on the planet. I have cancer. It's inoperable. Why me? I don't smoke. I hardly drink. Both my parents live to a ripe old age, etc., etc. Anyway, I have about 6 months, maybe more if I go for chemotherapy and all the rest of it. But I've already decided against it. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to spend my last remaining days plugged into an intravenous drip, with my head halfway down a toilet and my hair all over the bedroom floor. What's the point of that? And I'm not going to have myself wheeled around London literary functions, stick thin and coughing my guts out, with everyone queuing up to tell me how terribly sorry they all are, when actually they can't wait to see me go. Anyway, I know I was pretty foul to you, but in a way our whole relationship has been a profound fuck-up, and it might as well end the way it all began. When you and I first met, I remember the promises you made me, and to be fair to you, they've all come true. The money, anyway. So thank you for that. As to the money, there are bound to be rows when I've gone. James isn't going to be happy for one. I don't know why I'm mentioning this to you, as it's none of your business, but you might as well know that the two of us had more or less gone our separate ways, and I'm afraid I've cut him out altogether. God, I sound like a character in one of my own books. Anyway, he's just going to have to live with it. I hope he doesn't make too much trouble for you. On the literary side, things didn't work out quite the way I'd hoped, but we've talked about that often enough, and I'm not going to waste time rehearsing it here. You don't give a damn what I think about my career. You never have. It's one of the things I like about you. Sales, bestseller lists, those fucking Nielsen charts, All the stuff I've always loathed about publishing has always been bread, butter and jam to you. What will you do without me? It's just a shame I won't be around to find out. By the time that you read this, it will all be finished. You will forgive me for not having spoken to you earlier, for not taking you into my confidence. But I am sure that in time you will understand. There are some notes which I have written and which you will find in my desk. They relate to my condition and to the decision that I have made. I want it to be understood that the doctor's diagnosis is clear, and for me there can be no possibility of reprieve. I have no fear of death. I would like to think that my name will be remembered. I have achieved great success in a life that has gone on long enough. You will find that I have left you a small bequest in my will. This is partly to recognize the many years that we have spent together, but it is also my hope that you will be able to complete the work of my book and prepare it for publication. You are now its only guardian, but I am confident that it will be safe in your hands. Otherwise, there are few people who will mourn me. I leave behind me no dependents. As I prepare to take leave of this world, I feel that I have used my time well and hope that I will be remembered for the successes that you and I shared together. It has been quite an adventure, hasn't it? Why not take another look at the slide, just for old time's sake? Don't be angry with me. Remember all the money you've made. And here they are, my two favorite words. The end. As ever. Alan. This came this morning, I asked. Yes, you know the two of us had dinner on Thursday night. I took him to the club at the Ivy. This is dated the 28th of August, which is the next day. He must have written it as soon as he got home. Alan had a flat in Fitzrovia. He would have stayed overnight and taken the train from Liverpool Street the following morning. What's the slide? I asked. It was a book that Alan wrote a while back. You never showed it to me. I didn't think you'd be interested, to be honest. It wasn't a whodunit. It was something more serious, a sort of satire about 21st century Britain, set in a stately home. I'd still like to have seen it. Trust me, Susan, you'd have been wasting your time. There is no way I was going to publish it. Did you tell Alan that? Not in so many words. I just said that it wouldn't fit into our list. An old publishing euphemism. You don't tell your most successful author that his new book is no bloody good. The two of us sat in silence. Underneath the desk, the dog turned over and groaned. This is a suicide letter, I said. Yes. We have to send it to the police. I agree. I was about to call them. You didn't know he was ill? I knew absolutely nothing about it. He never told me, and he certainly didn't mention it on Thursday night. We had dinner. He gave me the manuscript. He was excited. He said it was his best work. I hadn't been there, and I'm writing this after the event. But this is what Charles told me had happened. Alan Conway had promised to deliver Magpie Murders by the end of the year, and unlike some writers I've worked with, he was always very prompt. The dinner had been planned a few weeks before, and it was no coincidence, incidentally, that it had been arranged while I was away. Alan and I didn't get on, for reasons I'll come to. He had met Charles at the Ivy, not the restaurant, but a private members-only club just off Cambridge Circus. There's a piano bar on the first floor, and a restaurant above, and all the windows have stained glass, so you can't see in, or, for that matter, out. Quite a few celebrities go there, and it's exactly the sort of place that Alan would have enjoyed. Charles had booked his usual table on the left of the door with a wall of bookshelves behind him. The scene couldn't have been better staged if it had been in a theatre. In fact, the St. Martin's Theatre and the Ambassadors, which had between them shown the Mousetrap for God knows how many years, were both down the road. The two of them started with large martini cocktails, which the club does very well. They talked about general stuff, family and friends, London, Suffolk, the book trade, a bit of gossip, what was selling, what wasn't. They chose their food, and because Alan liked expensive wine, Charles flattered him by ordering a bottle of Gevrey Chambertin Grand Cru, most of which Alan drank. I could imagine him becoming louder and more loquacious as the meal went on. He always did have a tendency to drink too much. The first course arrived, and it was after they had finished it that Alan produced the manuscript from the leather satchel he always carried. "I was very surprised," Charles said. "I wasn't expecting it for at least another couple of months." "You know that my copy is incomplete," I said. "It's missing the last chapters."
"Mine too.
I was just working on it when you came in." Did he say anything? I was wondering if Alan had done this on purpose. Perhaps he wanted Charles to guess the ending before it was actually revealed. Charles thought back.
"No. He just told me how good he thought it was and handed it over."
That was interesting. Alan Conway must have believed all the chapters were there. Otherwise, surely, he would have explained what he was doing. Charles had been delighted to receive the new work and made all the right noises. He told Alan he would read it over the weekend. Unfortunately, after that, the evening had taken a turn for the worse.
"I don't know what happened," Charles told me. "We were talking about the title. I wasn't sure I liked it, and you know how touchy Alan could be. Maybe it was foolish of me to bring it up just then.
And while we were talking, there was a rather odd incident. A waiter dropped a handful of plates. I suppose it could happen anywhere, but the club is such a quiet place that it was almost like a bomb going off. And Alan actually got up and remonstrated with the waiter. He'd been on edge all evening, and I had no idea why at the time. But if he was ill and already thinking of doing away with himself, I suppose it's hardly surprising."
"How did the meal end?" I asked.
"Alan calmed down a bit and we had coffee. But he was still out of sorts. You know how he could be after a few glasses of wine. Remember that ghastly Specsavers event? Anyway, as he was getting into his taxi, he said there was a radio interview he wanted to pull."
"Simon Mayo," I said.
"Radio 2?
"Yes. Next Friday."
I tried to talk him out of it. "You don't want to let these media people down, as you never know if they'll invite you back." But he wasn't having any of it. Charles turned the letter in his hands. I wondered if he should even be touching it. Wasn't it evidence?
"I suppose I should telephone the police," he said.
"They'll need to know about this."
I left him to make the call.
Alan Conway. I was the one who discovered Alan Conway. He was introduced to me by my sister, Katie, who lives in Suffolk, and who sent her children to the local independent school. Alan was an English teacher there, and had just finished a novel, a whodunit, called Atticus Punt Investigates. I'm not sure how he found out that she knew me. I suppose she must have told him, but he asked her if she would show it to me. My sister and I have very different lives, but we stayed close, and I agreed to take a look as a favour to her. I didn't think it would be any good, because books that come in this way, through the back door, seldom are. I was pleasantly surprised. Alan had captured something of the golden age of British whodunits, with a country house setting, a complicated murder, a cast of suitably eccentric characters, and a detective who arrived as an outsider. The book was set in 1946, just after the war, and although he was light with the period detail, he had still managed to capture something of the feelings of that time. Punt was a sympathetic character, and the fact that he had come out of the concentration camps, we eventually cut back on some of this, gave him a certain depth. I liked his Germanic mannerisms, particularly his obsession with his book, The Landscape of Criminal Investigation, which would become a regular feature. Setting the story in the 40s also allowed for a gentler pace. No mobile phones, computers, forensics, no instant information. I had a few issues. Some of the writing was too clever. It often felt as if he was fighting for effect rather than simply telling the story. It was too long. But by the time I'd come to the end of the manuscript,
I was certain that I was going to publish it, my first commission for Cloverleaf Books. And then I met the author. I didn't like him. I'm sorry to say it, but he just struck me as a bit of a cold fish. You'll have seen photographs of him on the book jackets, the slim face, the closely cropped silver hair, the round wire-framed glasses. On television or on the radio, he'd always had a sort of eloquence, an easy charm. He was nothing like that then. He was puffy and a little overweight, wearing a suit with chalk marks on the sleeves. His manner was at once aggressive and eager to please. He wasted no time telling me how much he wanted to be a published author, but he showed almost no enthusiasm now that the moment had come. I couldn't work him out. When I mentioned some of the changes I wanted him to make to his book, he positively bristled. He struck me as one of the most humorless people I had ever met. Later on, Katie told me that he had never been popular with the children, and I could understand why. To be fair, though, I have to say that I can't have made a great first impression either. Some meetings just happen that way. We'd arranged lunch in a smart restaurant, him, Charles, and me. It was pouring with rain that day, really chucking it down. I'd been at a meeting on the other side of town, and my taxi hadn't arrived, so I'd had to run half a mile in high heels. I turned up late, with my hair plastered down the side of my face, my shirt sodden, and my bra showing through. I knocked over a glass of wine as I sat down. I really wanted a cigarette, and that made me ratty. I remember we had an absurd argument about one section in the book. He'd gathered all the suspects in the library, and I just thought that was too cliched. But actually, this wasn't the right time to talk about that. Afterwards, Charles was quite angry with me, and he was right to be. We could have lost him, and there were plenty of other publishers who would have taken the book, particularly with the promise of a series. In fact, Charles took over and did most of the talking that day, and the result was that he was the one who ended up working with Alan. Which is to say, it was Charles who went to all the festivals, Edinburgh, Hay-on-Wye, Oxford, Cheltenham. Charles had the relationship. I just did the work, editing the books with a nifty software program that meant we didn't even have to meet face to face. It's funny to think that I worked with him for 11 years and never once visited his house. A little unfair, considering I actually paid for it. Of course, I saw him from time to time, whenever he came into the office, and I have to admit, the more successful he got, the more attractive he became. He bought expensive clothes, he went to the gym, he drove a BMW i8 coupe. These days, all writers have to be media performers, and Alan Conway was soon touring the studios on programs like The Book Show, The Right Stuff, and Question Time. He went to parties and award ceremonies. He talked at schools and universities. He had been 40 years old when he found fame, and it was as if it was only then that he began to live his life. He changed in other ways, too. He was married with an 8-year-old son when I met him. The marriage didn't last long. Reading what I've written, I sound disenchanted, as if I resented the success that, to a large extent, I had created for him. But that wasn't how I felt at all. I didn't care what he thought about me, and I was perfectly happy to let him and Charles hang out together at literary festivals while I set about the serious business, editing the text and overseeing the production of the books. At the end of the day, that was all that mattered to me. And the truth is that I really did love them. I grew up on Agatha Christie, and when I'm on a plane or on a beach, there's nothing I'd rather read than a whodunit. I've watched every episode of Poirot and Midsummer Murders on TV. I never guess the ending, and I can't wait for the moment when the detective gathers all the suspects in the room and, like a magician conjuring silk scarves out of the air, makes the whole thing make sense. So here's the bottom line. I was a fan of Atticus Punt. I didn't need to be a fan of Alan Conway, too. I had to field quite a few phone calls after I left Charles's office. Somehow, even before we had made the police aware of the letter, the news had got out that Alan had committed suicide, and there were journalists chasing the story. Friends in the industry called to commiserate. An antiquarian bookshop in Cecil Court wanted to know if we had any signed copies, as they were mounting a window display. I thought about Alan a lot that morning, but I thought more about a whodunit that was missing its solution, and, for that matter, a summer publishing schedule that had a huge hole at its center. After lunch, I went back in to see Charles.
"I've spoken to the police," Charles told me.
The letter was still in front of him, with the envelope next to it.
"They're sending someone round to collect it. They say I shouldn't have touched it."
"I don't see how you could have known that before you opened it."
"Quite."
"Did they tell you how he did it?" I asked. By "did it," I meant killed himself. Charles nodded.
"There's a sort of tower attached to his house. The last time I was there, it must have been March or April, I actually had a conversation with Alan about it. I said to him how dangerous it was. There's only a low wall and no railings or anything. It's funny, because when I heard there'd been an accident, I instantly assumed he must have fallen off the bloody thing. But now it looks as if he jumped."
There was a long silence. Usually Charles and I know what the other is thinking, but this time we were deliberately avoiding each other's eyes. It was really quite horrible that this had happened. Neither of us wanted to confront it. "What did you think of the book?" I asked. It was the one question I hadn't asked, the first thing in normal circumstances I would have wanted to know.
"Well, I read it over the weekend, and I was enjoying it very much. It seemed to me every bit as good as all the others. When I got to the last page, I was as irritated as you must have been. My first thought was that one of the girls must have made a mistake here in the office. I had two copies made, one for you, one for me."
That reminded me. "Where's Jemima?" I asked.
"She's left. She handed in her notice while you were on the road."
Suddenly he looked tired.
"She couldn't have chosen a worse time. This business with Alan. And there's Laura to think about, too."
Laura was his pregnant daughter. "How is she?" I asked.
"She's fine. But the doctors are saying it could happen any time. Apparently with the first one, it's more likely to be early."
He went back to what he'd been saying before.
"There are no missing pages, Susan. Not here, anyway. We've checked the copy room. We printed up exactly what Alan gave us. I was going to call him to ask what had happened. And then, of course, I heard the news."
"He didn't send you a copy electronically?"
"No. He never did that."
It was true. Alan was a pen and paper man. He actually hand-wrote his first draft. Then he typed it into his computer. He always sent us a printed copy before he emailed it to us, as if he somehow mistrusted us reading it on the screen. "Well, we'll have to find the missing chapters," I said, "and the sooner the better." Charles looked doubtful, so I went on. "They must be somewhere in the house. Did you manage to work out who did it?" Charles shook his head.
"I was thinking it might be the sister.
Clarissa Pye, yes. She was on my list, too.
There's always a chance he didn't actually finish it."
"I'm sure he'd have told you that when he handed it over. And what would have been the point?" I thought about my diary, all the meetings I had in the week ahead. But this was more important. "Why don't I drive up to Framlingham?" I said.
"Are you sure that's a good idea?
The police will still be at the house. If he committed suicide, there'll have to be an inquiry." "Yes, I know. But I'd like to get access to his computer."
"They'll have removed it, won't they?"
"Well, at least I can take a look around. The original could still be on his desk." He thought for a moment.
"Well, I suppose so."
I was surprised that he wasn't more enthusiastic. Although neither of us had said as much, we both knew how much we needed Magpie Murders. We'd had a bad year. In May, we published the biography of a comedian who'd made a joke in spectacularly poor taste live on TV. Almost overnight he'd stopped being funny, and his book had more or less vanished from the shops. I'd just been touring with an author of a first novel called The One-Armed Juggler, a comedy set in a circus. The tour might have gone well, but the reviews had been merciless, and we were having trouble getting copies into the shops. We'd had trouble with the building, a lawsuit, trouble with the staff. We weren't going under, but we badly needed a hit.
I'll go tomorrow, I said. I suppose there's no harm in trying. Would you like me to come with you?
No, I'll be fine on my own. Alan had never invited me to Abbey Grange. I would be interested to see what it was like. Give my love to Laura, I said, and if there's any news, let me know. I got up and left the room, and here's the strange thing. It was only as I walked back to my office that I realized what I had seen, even though it had been in front of my eyes all the time. It was very odd. It made no sense at all. Alan's suicide note and the envelope it had come in had been on Charles's desk. The letter was handwritten. The envelope was typed. Abbey Grange, Framlingham. The next morning, bright and early, I was speeding across the top of Alexandra Park with the virtually empty carcass of the famous palace above me, heading for the A12. It was a perfect excuse to take out the MGB Roadster that I had bought myself 6 years ago on my 40th birthday. It was a ridiculous car, but I'd known I had to have it the moment I saw it for sale outside a garage in Highgate. A 1969 model, manual with overdrive, and an in-your-face pillarbox red with black trim. Katie didn't know what to say when I first showed up in it, but her children went crazy for it, and whenever I saw them, I took them out, tearing around country lanes with the roof down and the two of them yelling in the back seat. I was going against the traffic that was coming into London and made good time until I got to Earl Soham, where a particularly annoying roadwork kept me waiting 10 minutes. It was a warm day. The weather had been good throughout the summer, and it looked as if September was going to be the same. I thought of putting the roof down, but it would be too noisy on the motorway, perhaps when I got nearer. I visited most of the seaside villages of Suffolk, Southwold, Walberswick, Dunwich and Orford, but I'd never been to Framlingham before. Maybe the very fact that Alan lived there had put me off. My first impressions as I drove in were of a pleasant, slightly down-at-heel town, centering on a main square that wasn't square at all. Some of the buildings had a certain charm, but others, an Indian restaurant, for example, looked oddly out of place, and if you were planning to go shopping, there wasn't going to be anything very exciting to buy. A large brick structure had imposed itself in the middle, and this turned out to contain a modern supermarket. I'd booked a room at the Crown Hotel, a coaching inn, that had looked out onto the square for 400 years, and now found itself rubbing shoulders with a bank and a travel agency. It was actually very charming, with the original flagstones, lots of fireplaces and wooden beams. I was glad to see books on the shelves and board games piled up on a community chest. They gave the place a homely feel. I found the receptionist tucked away behind a tiny window and checked in. I had thought about staying with my sister, but Woodbridge was a 30-minute drive away, and I would be happy enough here. I went up to my room and dumped my case on the bed, a four-poster no less. I wished Andreas was here to share it with me. He had a particular liking for Old England, especially if the old was spelled with an E. He found things like croquet, cream teas and cricket both incomprehensible and irresistible, and he would have been in his element here. I sent him a text, then washed and ran a comb through my hair. It was lunchtime, but I didn't feel like eating. I got back in the car and drove out to Abbey Grange. Alan Conway's home was a couple of miles outside Framlingham, and it would have been almost impossible to find without sat-nav. I've lived my whole life in a city where roads actually go somewhere because, frankly, they can't afford not to. The same couldn't be said for the country lane that twiddled its way through far too much country before an even narrower lane brought me to the private track that finally led me to the house itself. When did I realize that I was looking at the inspiration for Pye Hall? Well, the stone griffins beside the entrance gate would have been the first clue. The lodge house was exactly as described. The drive curved round to the front door, cutting through extensive lawns. I didn't see any rose gardens, but the lake was there, and so was the woodland that might have been Dingle Dell. I could easily imagine Brent standing beside the corpse of Tom Blakiston while his brother desperately gave him mouth to mouth. Most of the work had been done for me. And the house itself? What remained was a single, elongated wing with an octagonal tower constructed much later at the far end. As I drew up, that was exactly what I saw. A long, narrow building with about a dozen windows spread out over two floors, joined to a tower, which might provide great views, but which was in itself ridiculous. I guessed it had all been built in the 19th century, the creation of some Victorian industrialist who'd brought his memories of London's mills and mausoleums to rural Suffolk. It was nowhere near as attractive as Sir Magnus Pye's ancestral home, at least as Alan had described it. Abbey Grange was built out of the dirty red brick that I've always associated with Charles Dickens and William Blake. It didn't belong here, and it was saved only by its setting. The garden must have spread out over 4 or 5 acres, with a huge sky, and no other houses in sight. I wouldn't want to live here, and frankly, I couldn't see why it had appealed to Alan Conway either. Wouldn't he have been too metrosexual for this folly? This was where he had died. I was reminded of it as I got out of the car. Just 4 days ago, he had thrown himself off the tower that loomed over me even now. I examined the crenellations at the top. They didn't look very safe. If you leaned too far, suicidal or not, you might easily topple over. The tower was surrounded by lawn, the grass knotted and uneven. In Ian McEwan's novel, Enduring Love, there's an extremely good description of what happens to a human body when it falls from a great height, and I could easily imagine Conway, all mangled up, with his bones broken and his limbs pointing in the wrong direction. Would the fall have been enough to kill him instantly, or would he have lain there in agony until someone came along and found him? He lived alone, so it might have been a cleaner or a gardener who had raised the alarm. Did that make any sense? He had killed himself to avoid suffering, but in fact he might have suffered horribly. It wasn't the way I would have chosen. Get in a warm bath and cut your wrists. Jump in front of a train. Either would have been more certain. I took out my iPhone and moved away from the front door so that I could get a picture of the whole thing. I didn't know why I did that. But then why does anyone take photographs ever? We never look at them anymore. I had driven past a large shrub. It wasn't in the book. And walking back, I noticed two tire tracks. Quite recently, when the grass was damp, a car had parked behind it. I took a picture of the tire tracks, too. Not because they meant anything, but simply because I thought I should. I slipped the phone into my pocket, and I was walking back to the front door when it opened, and a man came out. I'd never met him, but I knew instantly who he was. I've mentioned that Alan was married. Shortly after the third book in the Atticus Punt series came out, so did Alan. He left his family for a young man called James Taylor, and by young, I mean barely 20, at a time when Alan himself was in his mid-40s with a son aged 12. His private life was no concern of mine, but I will admit that I was a little uneasy and worried about the effect it might have on sales. The story was reported in quite a lot of newspapers, but fortunately, this was 2009, and the journalists weren't able to sneer too much. Alan's wife Melissa and his son moved to the West Country. They agreed terms very quickly. That was when Alan had bought Abbey Grange. I had never met James Taylor, but I knew I was looking at him now. He was wearing a leather jacket and jeans, with a low-cut T-shirt that showed a thin gold chain around his neck. Although he was now 28 or 29, he still looked incredibly young, with a baby face that thick stubble did nothing to disguise. He had long fair hair which he hadn't brushed. It was slightly greasy, following the curve of his neck. He could have just got out of bed. His eyes were haunted, suspicious. I got the feeling that he had been damaged at some time in his life, or maybe it was just that he wasn't pleased to see me. "Yes?" he asked. "Who are you?" I'm Susan Ryland, I said. I work at Cloverleaf Books. We're Alan's publishers. I fished in my handbag and gave him my business card. He glanced at it, then looked past me. I like your car.
Thank you.
It's an MG. An MGB, actually. He smiled. I could tell it amused him, a woman of my age driving a car like that. I'm afraid that if you're here to see Alan, you're too late.
I know. I know what happened.
Do you think I could come in?
Why?
It's difficult to explain. I'm looking for something.
Sure.
He shrugged and opened the door as if he owned the place. But I had read Alan's letter. I knew he didn't. If this had been the world of Magpie Murders, the front door would have led into a grand hall with wood panels, a stone fireplace, and a staircase leading up to a gallery landing. But all that must have come out of Conway's imagination. In fact, the interior was disappointing. A reception room, stripped wooden floor, country furniture, expensive modern art on the walls, all very tasteful, but ordinary. No suits of armour, no animal trophies, no dead bodies. We turned right and went along a corridor that ran the full length of the house, finally bringing us into a serious kitchen with an industrial oven, an American fridge, gleaming surfaces, and a table that could seat 12. James offered me a coffee, which I accepted. He fixed it in one of those machines that use capsules and froths up the milk on the side.
So you're his publisher, he said.
No, his editor.
How well did you know Alan?
I wasn't sure how to answer that. It was a working relationship, I said. He never invited me here.
This is my home, or at least it was until about 2 weeks ago, when Alan asked me to move out. I hadn't left yet, because I didn't have anywhere to go. And now, I suppose, I may not have to. He brought the coffees over and sat down.
Do you mind if I smoke? I asked. I'd noticed an ashtray on the table and the smell of cigarette smoke in the air.
Not at all, he said. Actually, if you've got some cigarettes, I'll have one too.
I held out the packet, and suddenly we were friends. That's one of the only good things about being a smoker these days. You're part of a persecuted minority. You bond easily. But actually, I'd already decided that I liked James Taylor, this boy alone in a big house.
Were you here? I asked. When Alan killed himself?
No, thank God. We weren't together at that stage. I was in London, hanging out with some people I know.
I watched as he tapped ash. He had very long, slender fingers. His nails were dirty.
I got a call from Mr. Khan. He was Alan's solicitor. And I came back late on Monday. By then, the place was crawling with police officers. It was Mr. Khan who found him, you know. He came over to drop off some papers, probably cutting me out of the will or something, and Alan was on the lawn in front of the tower. I have to say I'm glad it wasn't me. I'm not sure I'd have coped.
He sucked in smoke, holding the cigarette cupped in his hand like a soldier in an old film.
What is it you're looking for?
I told him the truth. I explained that Alan had delivered his last novel just a couple of days before he died, and that it was missing the last chapter. I asked him if he had read any of Magpie Murders, and he gave a sniff of laughter.
I read every one of the Atticus Punt books, he said.
You know I'm in them.
I didn't know that, I said.
Oh, yes. James Fraser, the dumb blonde assistant. That's me. He flicked his own hair. When I first met Alan, he was just about to start Night Comes Calling. That's the fourth book in the series. That time, Atticus Punt didn't have an assistant. He just worked by himself. But after Alan and I started going out together, he said he was going to change that, and he put me in.
He changed your name, I said.
He changed lots of things. I mean, I never went to Oxford University for a start, although it's true I'd done some acting when we met. That was one of his little jokes. In every book, he always says Fraser was out of work or unsuccessful or failed. And of course, he was completely thick. But Alan said that was true of every sidekick. He used to say that they were there to make the detective look cleverer and to divert the attention away from the truth. Everything my character ever said in the books was wrong. He did it quite deliberately,
to make you look the wrong way. In fact, you could ignore whatever Fraser said. That was how it worked. So, did you read it? I asked again. He shook his head. No, I knew Alan was working on it. He used to spend hours in his office, but he never showed me anything until it was finished. To be honest with you, I didn't even know he had finished it. Usually he'd have given it to me before he showed it to anyone, but because of what had happened, he might have decided not to. Even so, I'm surprised I didn't know. I could usually tell when he'd come to the end. How? He became human again. I wanted to know what had happened between them, but instead, I asked if I could see his study and maybe look for the missing pages. James was quite happy to show me, and we left the room together. Alan's office was next to the kitchen, which made sense. If he ever needed a break, lunch or a drink, he didn't have far to go. It was a large room at the very end of the house with windows on three sides, and it had been knocked through to incorporate the tower. A spiral staircase dominated the space, and presumably led all the way to the top. There were two walls of books, the first of which turned out to be Alan's, the 9 Atticus Punt novels translated into 34 languages. The blurb, which I had written, says 35, but that includes English, and Alan liked round numbers. For the same reason, we upped his sales figures to 18 million, a figure we more or less plucked out of the air. There was a purpose-built desk, with an expensive-looking chair, black leather, ergonomically designed, with sections that would move to provide support for his arms, his neck, and his back. A writer's chair. He had a computer, an Apple with a 27-inch screen. I was interested in the room. It seemed to me that it was as close as I would get to walking into Alan Conway's head. And what did it tell me? Well, he wasn't out to hide his light. All his awards were on display. P.D. James had written a letter congratulating him on Atticus Punt Abroad, and he had framed it and hung it on the wall. There were also photographs of him with Prince Charles, with J.K. Rowling, and, odd this one, with Angela Merkel. He was methodical. Pens and pencils, notepads, files, newspaper clippings, and all the other detritus of a writer's life were laid out carefully with no sense of clutter. There was a shelf of reference books. The Shorter Oxford English Dictionary, 2 volumes. Roget's Thesaurus. The Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. Brewer's Book of Phrase and Fable. And encyclopedias of chemistry, biology, criminology, and law. They were lined up like soldiers. He had a complete set of Agatha Christie. About 70 paperbacks arranged, as far as I could see, in chronological order, beginning with The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. It was significant that they were also in his reference section. He had not read them for pleasure. He had used them. Alan had been entirely businesslike in the way he wrote. There were no diversions anywhere to be seen, nothing irrelevant to his work. The walls were white, the carpet a neutral beige. It was an office, not a study. A leather diary sat beside the computer, and I flicked it open. I had to ask myself what I was doing. It was the same reflex that had made me take a photograph of the tire tracks in the garden. Was I looking for clues? A page torn out of a magazine had been slotted in beneath the cover. It was a black-and-white photograph, a still from Steven Spielberg's 1993 film Schindler's List. It showed the actor Ben Kingsley sitting at a desk typing. I turned to James Taylor. "What's this doing here?" I asked. He answered as if it was obvious. "That's Atticus Punt," he said. It made sense. His eyes, behind the round wire-framed glasses, examined the doctor with endless benevolence. It had often been remarked that Atticus Punt looked like an accountant, and in his general demeanour, which was both timid and meticulous, he behaved like one too. Alan Conway had borrowed, or perhaps stolen, his detective from a film that had been released 10 or so years before he had written the first book. This might be where the link with the concentration camps, which I had thought so clever, had begun. For some reason, I was deflated. It was disappointing to find out that Atticus Punt was not an entirely original creation, that he was in some way second-hand. Perhaps I was being unfair. After all, every character in fiction has to begin somewhere. Charles Dickens used his neighbours, his friends, even his parents as an inspiration. Edward Rochester, my favourite character in Jane Eyre, was based on a Frenchman called Constantine Heger, with whom Bronte was in love. But tearing an actor out of a magazine was different somehow. It felt like cheating. I turned the pages of the diary until I arrived at the week we were in now. It would have been busy if he'd managed to live through it. On Monday, he was having lunch with someone called Claire at the Jolly Sailor. He had a hair appointment in the afternoon. That was the obvious assumption from the single word hair with a circle round it. On Wednesday, he was playing tennis with someone identified only by their initials, S.K. On Thursday, he was coming to London. He had another lunch. He'd just written L.C.H. And at 5, he was seeing Henry at the O.V. It took me a worrying amount of time to work out that this was actually Henry V at the Old Vic. Simon Mayo was still in the diary for the following morning. This was the interview that Alan had decided to cancel, but he hadn't got round to crossing it out. I flicked back a page. There was the dinner with Charles at the Ivy Club. In the morning, he'd seen S.B., his doctor. "Who's Claire?" I asked. "His sister." James was standing beside me, peering at the diary. "The Jolly Sailor's in Orford. That's where she lives." "I don't suppose you know the password for the computer." "Yes, I do. It's Atticus. The same name as the detective, except with the figure 1 instead of the letter I." James turned the computer on and tapped it in. I don't need to go into all the details of Alan's computer. I wasn't interested in his emails, his Google history, or the fact that he played electronic Scrabble. All I wanted was the manuscript. He used Word for Mac, and we quickly found the last two novels, Red Roses for Atticus and Atticus Punt Abroad. There were several drafts for each, including the ones I had sent him with the final amendments. But there wasn't a single word of Magpie Murders in any of his files. It was as if the computer had been deliberately wiped clean. "Is this his only computer?" I asked. "No, he's got another one in London, and he also had a laptop. But this is the one he used for the book, I'm sure of it." "Could he have put it on a memory stick?" "I'm not sure I ever saw him with memory sticks, to be honest with you, but I suppose it's possible." We searched the room. We went through every cupboard and every drawer. James was keen to help. We found hard copies of all the Atticus Punt novels, apart from the most recent. There were notepads containing lengthy extracts, scratched out in pen and ink. But anything relating to Magpie Murders was curiously absent, as if it had been deliberately removed. One thing I did find that interested me was an unbound copy of The Slide, the novel that Charles had mentioned and which he had rejected. I asked James if I could borrow it and set it aside to take back with me. There were piles of newspapers and old magazines. Alan had kept everything ever written about him, interviews, profiles, reviews, the good ones, the works. It was all very neat. One cupboard was given over to stationery, with envelopes stacked up in their respective sizes, reams of white paper, more writing pads, plastic folders, a full spectrum of post-it notes. There was no sign of a memory stick, though, and if it had been there, it was probably too small to find. In the end, I had to give up. I'd been there an hour. I could have continued all day. "You could try Mr. Kahn," James suggested. "Alan's solicitor," he reminded me. "He's got offices in Framlingham, on the Saxmundham Road. I don't know why he would have it, but Alan gave a lot of stuff to him." He paused a fraction too long. "His will, for example." He had already joked about that when I arrived. "Are you going to continue living here?" I asked him. It was a loaded question. He must know that Alan had been intending to disinherit him. "God, no. I couldn't sit here by myself in the middle of nowhere. I'd go mad. Alan once told me that he'd left the house to me, but if that turns out to be the case, I'll go back to London.
That's where I was living when we met.
He curled his lip.
We'd had a bad patch recently. We'd more or less split up. So maybe he changed things. I don't know.
I'm sure Mr. Khan will tell you, I said.
He hasn't said anything yet.
I'll go and see him.
I'd talk to his sister if I were you, James suggested. She used to do a lot of work for him. She did all his administration and his fan mail. I think she may even have typed some of the earlier books. He used to show them to her in manuscript. There's always a chance he gave the latest one.
You said she's in Orford.
I'll give you the address and number.
While he took out a sheet of paper and a pen, I wandered over to the one cupboard which I hadn't opened, and which was set in the middle of the wall behind the spiral staircase. I thought it might contain a safe. After all, Sir Magnus Pye had had one in his study. It opened peculiarly, one half sliding up, the other down. There were two buttons set in the wall. I realized it was a dumb waiter.
Alan had that built, James explained without looking up. He always ate outside if the weather was warm enough, breakfast and lunch. He put the plates and food in and sent them up.
Could I see the tower? I asked.
Sure. I hope you've got a head for heights.
The staircase was modern, made of metal, and I found myself counting the steps as I tramped up. It seemed to go on too long. Surely the tower hadn't been this high. Finally, a door locked from inside led out to a wide circular terrace with a very low crenellated wall. Charles had been right about that. From here, I could see across a sea of treetops and fields, all the way back to Framlingham. In the far distance, Framlingham College, 19th century Gothic, perched on a hill. I noticed something else. Although it was screened by woodland and invisible from the road, there was a second property, right next to Abbey Grange. I would have reached it if I had continued up the drive, but there was also what looked like a footpath between the trees. It was large and fairly modern, with a very well-kept garden, a conservatory, a swimming pool. "Who lives there?" I asked.
"That's the neighbour. His name is John White. He's a hedge fund manager."
Alan had arranged a table and four chairs, a gas barbecue, and two sun loungers on the terrace. Quite nervously, I made my way to the edge and looked down. From this angle, the ground looked a long way away, and I could easily imagine him plunging down. I had a sick feeling in my stomach, and stepped back, only to feel James's hands pressing into my back. For a horrible moment, I thought he was about to push me. The surrounding wall was really inadequate. It barely came up to my waist. He stepped away, embarrassed.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I was just worried you might get dizzy. A lot of people do coming up here for the first time."
I stood there with the breeze tugging at my hair. "I've seen enough," I said. "Let's go down." It would have been so easy to throw Alan Conway over the edge. He wasn't a large man. Anyone could have crept up here and done it. I don't know why I thought that, because it was clear that no crime had been committed. He had left a handwritten suicide note. Even so, once I got back to my car, I rang the Old Vic in London, and they confirmed that he had booked two tickets for Henry V on Thursday. I told them he wouldn't be needing them. What was interesting was that he had only made the booking on the Saturday, one day before he killed himself. His diary had shown that he had also arranged meetings, lunches, a haircut, and a tennis match. And despite everything, I had to ask myself, was this really the behavior of a man who had decided to take his own life?
Wesley and Khan, Framlingham. I drove back to Framlingham, parked the car in the main square, and walked the rest of the way. The town really was a bit of a mishmash. At the far end, there was a well-preserved castle, surrounded by swathes of grass and a moat, a perfect fantasy of England as it might have been at the time of Shakespeare, complete with a pub and a duck pond nearby. But another 50 yards, and the charm came to an abrupt end, with Saxmundham Road, wide and modern, stretching into the distance, a golf garage on one side, and an assortment of very ordinary houses and bungalows on the other.
Wesley and Kahn, the firm of solicitors used by Alan Conway, occupied a mustard-coloured building on the edge of the town. It was a house, not an office, despite the signage beside the front door. I wasn't sure if Mr. Kahn would see me without an appointment, but I walked in anyway. I needn't have worried. The place was quite dead, with a girl reading a magazine behind the reception desk, and a young man staring vacantly at a computer screen opposite. The building was old, with uneven walls and floorboards that creaked. They'd added grey carpets and strip lighting, but it still looked like somebody's home. The girl rang through. Mr. Kahn would see me. I was shown upstairs and into what must have been the master bedroom, now converted into a no-nonsense office looking out onto the garage. Sajid Kahn, his full name was on the door, rose up from behind a reproduction antique desk with a green leather top and brass handles. It was the sort of desk you chose if you wanted to make a point. He was a large, effusive man in his 40s, bullish in his movements and in the way he spoke. "Come in, come in. Please take a seat. Have you been offered tea?" He had very black hair and thick eyebrows that almost met. He was wearing a sports jacket with patches on the elbows and what might well have been a club tie. It seemed unlikely that he had been born in Framlingham, and I wondered what had brought him to such a backwater, and for that matter, how he fitted in with Mr. Wesley. There was a photo frame beside him, one of those modern digital ones, with the image changing every 30 seconds, either sliding or corkscrewing into itself. Before I'd even sat down, I'd been introduced to his wife, two daughters, his dog, and an elderly woman in a hijab who might have been his mother. I don't know how he lived with it. It would have driven me mad. I declined the offer of tea and sat down in front of the desk. He took his place, and I briefly explained why I was there. His demeanour changed at the mention of Alan's name. "I found him, you know," he told me. "I went round there on Sunday morning. Alan and I were having a meeting. Have you been out to the house? And although you may not believe it, I must tell you that I had a feeling something was wrong even as I drove up. That was before I saw him. And to start with, I had no idea what I was looking at. I thought someone had thrown some old clothes onto the lawn. Really, I did. Then I realized it was him. I knew at once he was dead. I did not go near. I called the police at once." "You were quite close to him, I understand." Sajid Kahn was SK in the diary. The two of them played tennis together, and he had gone over to the house on a Sunday. "Yes," he said. "I'd read many of the Atticus Punt novels before I met him, and you could certainly say I was a great admirer of his work. As things turned out, we did a lot of business with him, and I'm very happy to say that I got to know him well. In fact, I would go so far as to say that, yes, we were definitely friends." "When did you last see him?"
"About a week ago."
"Did you have any idea he was planning to kill himself?"
"Absolutely none at all. Alan was in this office, sitting exactly where you are now. We were actually talking about the future, and he seemed to be in perfectly good spirits."
"He was ill."
"So I understand. But he never mentioned it to me, Miss Ryland. He called me on Saturday evening. I must have been one of the last people who spoke to him while he was still alive. It would have been hard to speak to him if he wasn't, I thought. Always the editor."
"May I ask what you talked about, Mr. Kahn? And why were you visiting him on a Sunday? I know it's not my business." I smiled sympathetically, inviting him to take me into his confidence.
"Well, I suppose it can't hurt telling you now. There had been certain changes to his domestic arrangements, and Alan had decided to rethink his will. I'd actually drawn up a new draft, and I took it over to show him. He was going to sign it on Monday."
"He was going to cut out James Taylor."
He frowned. "Forgive me if I don't go into the details. I don't think it would be appropriate."
"It's all right, Mr. Kahn. He wrote to us at Cloverleaf Books. He actually told us he was going to take his own life, and he mentioned that James was no longer in his will."
"Again, I don't think it's my place to comment on any communication he may have had with you."
Kahn paused, then let out a sigh.
"I will be honest with you and say that I did find that side of Alan quite hard to fathom."
"You mean his sexuality?"
No, of course not. That's not what I meant at all. But having a partner who was quite so much younger than him. Khan was getting himself into difficulties, trying to balance...